is Rolander L. Brown. Mr. Riley, good morning to you. Because we have to use this door, we'll have some traffic in and out. So let's give everybody a second to get in and out if they need to. Which now appears to have happened, so you may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Thomas Riley, Public Defender's Office of Douglas County. On behalf of the appellant, Rolander Brown, who was originally charged with murder in the first degree, use of a firearm, committed a felony, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. After a jury trial, he was convicted of the lesser included offense of second degree murder and the other two charges, and was sentenced to a total of 100 to 140 years in prison. I've raised several issues, one of which is excessive sentence, and I would ask the court permission to submit that on the briefs, which would be more typical of what we do in those kind of cases, and allow me to address the two primary issues that I want to speak about, which is whether or not the good faith exception saves the search, for lack of a better term, or the law enforcement's obtaining cell site location information on the defendant's phone. And secondly, whether or not the trial court erred when it allowed the primary witness for the state to testify that he had been shot and his girlfriend shot and killed in an incident that was unrelated to this matter. The court ruled that it was admissible to show that the witness had a life-changing event, which our position is irrelevant, and if it isn't, its probative value is far outweighed by the unfair prejudice. But if I may proceed first with the Fourth Amendment issue. Obviously, prior to trial, the Omaha police got a court order under the Federal Stored Communications Act to obtain the cell site location information of the defendant, which was used at trial to demonstrate that his phone was in the vicinity, in close proximity to the scene of the shooting, and also was used to corroborate Paris Stamps, who is the witness who I just mentioned, testimony as to where he met with the defendant after the shooting. The cell site location information also included information that would allow the jury to determine that his phone, the defendant's phone, was in close proximity to addresses that Paris Stamps claimed they had been to shortly after the shooting. I was aware that this Carpenter case was kind of in the works, and filed a motion to suppress, alleging that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy, Fourth Amendment right. Obviously, during the pendency of the case, this court decided, I believe, Jenkins case, which determined that there was no right to privacy on cell site location information, and Judge Gleason, in his order denying our motion, relied almost entirely on the Jenkins case. I'm sure you've read the order, and it's pretty brief, and he says this falls back under the case of Jenkins, therefore motion overruled. The state concedes in its brief that the Carpenter case obviously overrules Jenkins, and the question becomes whether or not the good faith exception can be utilized to rescue the state in allowing them to rely on the admissibility of that evidence based on good faith. Obviously, the first case that would be of significance would be Illinois versus Kroll, which basically says that a state statute or a statute that is relied upon for a search, and that was basically that statute in Illinois was a statute allowing police to unilaterally search used car lots, junk lots for, to determine if there's stolen auto parts, et cetera. And in that case, the trial court and the Illinois Supreme Court determined that the statute was unconstitutional, and Kroll said, well, even if it is, the good faith exception applies. The difference is that in Kroll, there was evidence at the trial level about good faith. In this case, in the case before us today, the state relied solely and only upon the validity of the Federal Stored Communications Act. They mentioned nothing about good faith. There was no evidence presented about good faith.
Is the good faith inquiry a subjective or an objective inquiry?
Well, I think it's a combination. The truth of the matter is, when we look at the Leon case, there are a number of factors that go into whether there's good faith or not. Whether or not, for instance, is the magistrate just a rubber stamp? Well, there has to be some evidence to determine whether or not every time the police go and offer in front of the magistrate an order under the Federal Stored Communications Act, whether or not they'll just automatically approve it. Secondly, what training do the officers have to show that they're up to speed, so to speak? They can't just rely on good faith and say, well, ignorance is bliss, and I don't know about anything. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not responsible for that. There has to be some.
I understand how that could apply in a Leon situation where we're talking about the officers submitting an affidavit to get a warrant, but the Kroll case is different, right? It's talking about a statute that they're relying on.
Well, but that's why this is a hybrid, because in this that was unilateral action by the police. They didn't have to go to a judge. They didn't have to present a warrant, an affidavit. In this case, they do under the Federal Stored Communications Act. They can't just send a letter to the cell provider and say, give me the stuff. They had to get a court order to do it. So Kroll, while the basic premise of, okay, good faith can't apply when it's a statute, not just on a search, it doesn't say that that's as far as the inquiry goes. Matter of fact, what this court has said in State versus Tompkins, that an appellate court cannot sua sponte raise good faith. And what I'm asking you to do is extend that a little bit further and give us some guidance on how to handle these things. If the basic premise of Tompkins is allowing the court to raise it on an appellate level for the first time deprives the defendant of the ability to address this, I don't see how this is any different.
I think the distinction might be as to Thompson, with the court becoming an advocate for one outcome, as
well,
distinguished
that may,
from a party, even it, albeit lately. I was going to say, maybe this is too recent, and I haven't absorbed it. But
last week,
Nelson. Is Nelson relevant to our Nielsen relevant to our conversation?
I don't know. I don't know. I know there's a case that came out last week that talked about this, and as I recall, there was evidence presented, at least argument presented, on good faith at the trial level. None of that happened in this case. And my point about Tompkins is, while what Your Honor is referencing makes some sense, the bottom line is, the premise is not giving the defendant the opportunity to combat whether or not good faith is present or not.
Could you combat it in this case?
Sure. We could say, okay, Officer Smith, you applied for how many orders under the Federal Stored Communications Act have you applied for in Douglas County? 20. How many did the judges approve? 20. That, I think, is evidence of whether or not the independence of the magistrate is compromised.
But secondly, wouldn't that go to whether the standard was met under the Stored Communications Act, and is there any suppression remedy for a violation of the Stored Communications Act?
But no, but that's water over the dam now, because we're under the Fourth Amendment now, not the Federal Stored Communications Act.
I'm trying to understand what sort of, what opportunity to show the absence of good faith you lost in this case, and that's what I'm struggling with.
Sure, that, what I just referred to. Secondly, is what training had the officers have been under? I cited in my reply brief a case from 2014, a federal case, that specifically made mention of the fact that there is a definite split in authority as to whether or not the Federal Stored Communications Act violated the Fourth Amendment or not. There are cases on each side. So what training? I mean, that's an issue in good faith. I think we apply good faith to willy-nilly and say, well, if a judge approved it, the police should be able to rely on it, end of story. I don't think that's what Leon talks about, and I'm asking this court to give us some further guidance and say, hey, look, state, if you're going to rely on good faith, you have to raise it at the trial level. That's the standard we're all always held to. We didn't raise it at the trial level, it's waived. Well, why does the state have an opportunity to get a second bite at the apple with us having no opportunity other than to answer hypothetical questions like the court just asked, instead of giving us an opportunity to present evidence at the trial? What training have you had, Officer Smith, in regard to the Federal Stored Communications Act and the Fourth Amendment? Are you aware of these things? There has to be some training. That's what Leon talks about. Good faith doesn't mean give a judge or a magistrate an affidavit and have him sign it and then we're all good. That's not where we're at.
Did the state argue reliance upon Jenkins at the motion to suppress?
I'm sorry?
Did the state argue reliance upon the Jenkins case at the motion to suppress?
I don't know if they did, but the judge did. I think they did. I think they did. I can't look you in the eye and say I 1,000% recall it. But I'm sure there were briefs submitted and that are not in the record necessarily, but I'm sure Jenkins was brought to the court's attention. And I may have done it myself. I mean, I can't.
So after those arguments were made and the ruling came out, then Carpenter overturned Jenkins, correct?
Yes, that's right. That's true. But my point was that this was coming through the pipeline, and there were a number of cases that went out the way. Plus, the fact of the matter is, maybe the law enforcement, the county attorney's office, the police, under the Federal Stored Communications Act, you can also ask for a search warrant. Maybe it would be wise to err on the side of caution instead of trying to take the easy way out. We'll do whatever the least amount of investigation and evidence we have to present to you to allow us to get this cell site location information. That's what they did. And to show the confusion, this court reprimanded all the attorneys and the trial judge in Jenkins saying, will you stop calling this a search warrant? It's a court order under the Federal Stored Communications Act. And look at the document in this case, and it's the same thing. It says search warrant. It's not a search warrant. So just right there shows a lack, in my opinion, a lack of training and a lack of willingness to stay up to speed on what the law is or where it's heading that should be considered. And I didn't get a chance to argue my 403 argument, but I'll have to rely on the brief unless you want to give me a little more time.
I think we'll rely on the brief.
I thought that was the answer. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Originally, the primary issue on appeal was whether the state violated Brown's Fourth Amendment rights when it acquired his CSLI without first obtaining a warrant. We now know, based on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Carpenter, the answer is yes. Consequently, the issue here is no longer whether a violation occurred, but rather what do we do about it, or more specifically, whether unlawfully obtained evidence should be excluded. The state submits the answer is no, because despite the violation, the evidence remains admissible pursuant to the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. Now, Brown contends, however, that this court should decline to apply the good faith exception because the state didn't raise it below. Our response is twofold. One, the state did raise the issue of good faith during the second suppression hearing on July 3rd, which is contained in the supplemental bill of exceptions that the defendant requested and filed with the court more than 2 weeks before he submitted his reply brief. How he missed it, I don't know. Two, his contention ignores the district court's ruling on the motion to suppress. In addition to rejecting the Fourth Amendment claim based on this court's decision in Jenkins, the district court also found that the law enforcement officers obtained the information pursuant to a valid court order authorized by the Federal Stored Communications Act. If that finding is correct, as we submit that it is, then a finding of good faith is a foregone conclusion. As we argued in our brief, at the time this search occurred, law enforcement had no reason to believe that there were any restrictions on their ability to acquire this information apart from those imposed by statute, which it complied with. That is the very essence of good faith. Whereas here, law enforcement complied with the law in effect at the time the search occurred, and there is no police misconduct in need of deterrence. In other words, the exclusionary rule serves no legitimate purpose. Exclusion is simply not appropriate here. But assuming the good faith exception is inapplicable and the evidence was erroneously admitted, the state submits the error was harmless since the record contains substantial and compelling evidence, apart from the CSLI, that shows that Brown committed the murder. That evidence includes Stamps' testimony, the video from JT's convenience store, the call detail records, which corroborate parts of the witness's testimony, and of course the two incidents of flight, which suggest consciousness of guilt. That brings me to the only other issue I intend to address.
Before you go there, how have other courts treated the Carpenter case in regard to the good faith exception?
I have done some research on that. Of course, I cited the Chavez case in my brief, but I have done some additional research, and it appears to me based on, I looked only at federal court cases since we construe our constitution to be consistent with the Constitution, that most of the district courts and the federal courts of appeal that have addressed it, 7th, 2nd Circuit, 11th, are applying the good faith exception and saying, look, you relied on these court orders that were issued pursuant to this act, and they're doing the Kroll analysis there, that good faith applies. They could reasonably rely on that.
Are those courts relying only on Kroll, or are they moving on to this second question that appellant's counsel is suggesting needs to be answered about subjective good faith and training, the history of the magistrate?
Well, I think that implicates the Leon exception, and unless there's a problem with the warrant or the court order, as we're talking about here, whether there's some issue as to its validity, I'm not sure that we necessarily go there. Now, the U.S. or the Seventh Circuit's opinion in U.S. v. Curtis is they basically looked at it simply as an issue of Kroll. Like, okay, well, these orders were issued pursuant to this act. They cited Kroll, and he attempted to make some of the similar, I think, distinctions that Mr. Riley was trying to make here today, and they rejected those. And I can give you the citation of that case if you would like it.
I think I have it.
It's 901 F3D 846, and it was decided on August 24th of this year. But as I said, the only other issue I intend to address is whether the district court erred in allowing Stamps to testify that he and his girlfriend had been shot prior to trial. Again, we submit there was no error. As this court is aware, Stamps was the state's primary witness, and his...
Was that testimony solicited by the state, or was it spontaneous on the part of the witness, and does that make a difference?
It was solicited by the state. There was a pretrial hearing. They made it known to the district court that they wanted to ask him, one, about gang affiliation, and two, about this shooting, to show or to explain why he had flip-flopped on his testimony, because he originally provided a statement to law enforcement in which he implicated Brown. Then he recanted after his friends found out about it, and he filed a complaint against Otter, threatened to sue him for defamation, and he was not cooperating, but then he got shot, and he came around and decided that he was going to testify.
So why was it important to make that explanation to the jury?
Because I think he was going to be subject to attack. His credibility was going to be attacked based on the fact that he had changed his position, and they simply wanted to head off any speculation about that or attacks on that, but saying, okay, well, why did you do that? Why is it that you eventually decided to cooperate? And that was what the basis of the shooting was, is that, you know, the reason that he came around was because he had recently been affected or, you know, personally touched by the very same type of gun violence that cost Carlos Alonso his life, and he felt to come forward and clear his conscience.
So it was done in anticipation of cross-examination?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, they wanted to explain it. It was done in anticipation of that, but importantly for our
purposes. Was it collateral information on the direct?
Well, I think it was relevant to the issue of his credibility. I mean, it was certainly something the jury was going to be asked to decide, whether they believed him or not, but I think importantly for our purposes here, district court, prior to his testimony, gave very thorough and explicit limiting instruction, which made it abundantly clear that Brown had nothing to do with the shooting and that Stamps' testimony was being offered only to show the effect that it had on him. And given that instruction, coupled with the substance of Stamps' testimony and the manner in which it was argued by the prosecutor during closing, I think there's zero chance that the jury misused that evidence.
On what basis did the defense object to Stamps' testimony?
Well, originally, my understanding of it was when I was reviewing my notes was that it was 503. And that was both the gang affiliation objected to on 503, and the same goes for the shooting. I think at trial, he may have tossed in a relevance objection. But I think in his brief on appeal, he has conceded that it was at least marginally relevant and has again gone hard on the it's unfairly prejudicial, which we disagree. But that's really all I have. If there are further questions, we ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There's no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day.